Accession number 30,001, Mr. Peter Ayrst, Reel 15. Now, were there any other characters that come to your mind amongst the, either the senior or the pilots of 238 Squadron, A flight or the B flight?
Well, I was posted to command A flight, and the B flight commander was a South African captain by the name of Tom Phillips, and he was a very good chap, but he hadn't got the same background and depth of experience as I had, for instance, because he hadn't been in Europe. He'd come to the Desert Air Force from South Africa, and they hadn't had any previous operational experience. So they were gaining all their experience on site in the desert. But he was a very good chap.
Any other senior pilots that, or pilots that just stick in your mind?
Oh, quite a few, yes. Yes. I had various nationalities, Canadians, Kenyans, and I had a young South African lieutenant in my flight. It was quite an odd mixture, really, but they were all jolly good chaps, and they, we had a wonderful relationship in the flight, and everyone got on very well together.
So there's no jealousies or problems?
No.
Now, when did you start up operations with well, almost straight away, I suppose, with 238?
Oh, yes. I was posted to them on the 31st of October. On the 1st of November, I did a patrol of the line with number one South African Air Force as top cover. And I've got no enemy aircraft seen, a slight amount of breeder flak near the coast. I can't remember what breeder flak was now, but some sort of flak. I think it was the heavier type flak, but otherwise we wouldn't have seen it. So that was on the very first day with the squadron. I did an operational patrol. Then I didn't do anything on the second. On the third, I did a patrol of the line. Met 30 plus Stukas and 20 plus 109s. And I got here very heavy anti-aircraft fire, followed by the Stuka party. So they were shooting at us from the ground, and then we got into their Stukas. I had several squirts at 109s and probably damaged two. The same day, on the third, I did another patrol of the line, and there were several 109s around. And 109s attacked number 33 squadron, who were our top cover. We were in the lower level looking for the dive bombers. The 33 who were above us, which was my previous squadron, were doing the top cover, and I got here 109s attacked. Useless attacks, plenty of activity on the ground.
You don't seem to have ever got through to the Stukas. Is that correct, or is it... You seem to have mainly dealt with the
Yes,
who are covering the Stukas.
Yes, although...
I may be a wrong
impression. You see, now, yes, in many ways you're right, because on the 4th of November, the next day, which happened to be my birthday...
let's go on to that, because that's quite a story, I know.
Yeah.
So what happened on your birthday that year? You were...
Well, I did one... we scrambled for a Stuka...
One thing I haven't done, it's from my fault, is we haven't actually discussed what a scramble is, how it actually works.
I mean, a scramble means getting off very quickly.
There's this Battle of Britain picture where people are sat, and, you know, around
yes.
and run to yeah. the aeroplane. How did you... What were you doing when you were scrambled? We had
our own operations vehicle, and because they were on... They had a connection with the group control centre, and it was the group control centre that had links with radar and what have you, and were getting the information in about any possible enemy aircraft that might have been airborne, and which they could pick up on their on their radar. And then they would let our chaps know, and then they would tell us and say, they want you to scramble, get off as quickly as you can, which we did on this particular day. And I called it Scramble for the Stuka Party. There were obviously quite a lot of Stukas trying to bomb the troops, and that's why they wanted us airborne quickly to try and intercept them. But I've got here, Scramble for Stuka Party. Mr. Stukas, they'd gone, they'd done their job and met, pissed off home. But then we got caught up with the 109 escort. And there were 12 plus 109s in the area. And we got mixed up with them.
And do you remember that dogfight?
Yes, I do. They were all over the sky, and so were we. And I destroyed one, and I damaged another.
Now, do you remember how? Peter, this is a split-second incident, sort of 65 years ago, but do you remember what happened?
Yes, I was on the tail of one, and it got right behind him, and I followed him around. He was trying to avoid me, but I was able to turn inside him, and I shot him down. He went down into the ground from about 8,000 feet.
So you could actually see that one crash. There's no question about that one.
Oh, yes, I saw it. But I didn't sort of hang around looking for him to crash. But I did see him crash when I was getting behind another 109, you see. And I damaged him. I didn't destroy him, as far as I know. He may have gone in later, but as far as I know, I only damaged him. But there's an awful lot of flak coming up at that time at us. And I got shot up three times by heavy air cat. I had a lot of damage to my starboard wing, out towards the wingtip where the ailerons were. And I had another one in the tailplane, and another one in the engine. So those three heavy shots of AKAC damaged my aircraft considerably, and I hadn't got full control or full power. And I was losing height because I was well over the German lines. And then I was losing height, couldn't maintain my height. So from about 8,000 or 9,000 feet, I immediately turned in an easterly direction to make for our own lines. And I didn't know whether I'd be able to make it or not, but so I was, all the time I was losing height, all the troops on the ground, and they had light AKAC there, they were firing with anything they could get hold of. And I could hear that I was being hit as I was weaving around, despite the fact that I hadn't got much control or much power. And then I saw a track ahead of me, and I thought, I've got to get down there, come what may.
This is behind the German lines still?
I was still behind the German lines, but the track I could see, I didn't know exactly where it was. I had no option, because I had no power to go it any further, to go east. So I thought, I've got to make a wheels-up crash landing on there, come what may.
Now, you said wheels-up before. Why wheels-up? Was there no point in putting the wheels
up? No, well, it's just soft. Might have been soft sand if you've gone over.
So you were better off pancaking?
Oh, yes, much, yes. When you don't know the ground, you don't know what's there, although it looked like a track. You couldn't possibly, and wasn't enough distance or length to land there anyway with the wheels down.
So the wheels would make it a worse crash?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, I would sort of hope in hell if I put the wheels down.
So, what was the landing like? How did it feel?
Well, it was all right. Because it hit the ground, I kept the nose well up, and then the fuselage dropped down, they pull up to a halt fairly quickly.
How far? Roughly.
30, 40 yards.
So, not
50 yards. But I'm not far. I mean, once you see you've
then
just got
a couple of cricket pitches, then at most sort of thing.
Well, when you're in the desert with the aircraft, no wheels down, it's just gaunching along, and you don't go far under those conditions. But
were you thrown about a lot, or was it reasonably smooth?
No, well, once I'd got down on the ground, it was all right. It's a fairly sudden jar, and you pull up quickly. The next thing, this is about 5:30 in the afternoon, and you know the period. This was in the 4th of November, and in November the period of twilight is very short. You go from daylight to darkness in about half an hour. And once I crash landed, I leapt out of the cockpit and lay flat on the ground because I was still within firing range of the German troops in their front lines. And I didn't exactly know where I was. I knew I was close to their front line. So I didn't.
So were you in no man's land?
Yes, basically I was, but I didn't know it at the time.
So you thought you were landing behind the German lines, but in
well, I didn't know exactly where it was. I think in many ways I did think I was in the German lines.
So you were under fire, so you got out of the aircraft.
I lay flat on the ground. I didn't move because the German troops were still firing at me. And about half an hour later, it got dark. And I thought, well, I've got to try and start to walk now. And I sort of shook myself down, and I heard a vehicle coming up very fast. And I thought, oh, God, here come the Germans. Now I should be a prisoner of war for the rest of the war. That's exactly what I thought. And instead of which, it was a jeep with an Australian major and his driver in it. And as it really was going fast, his voice called out when he got near the aircraft, "Anybody there?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Get in quick." And he said to his driver, "Go as fast as you can." So I was in no man's land, you see. And I didn't really know it at the time. But I thought it was a German vehicle, and I thought, oh, God, prisoner of war now. But anyway, for about 20 or 25 minutes, we were going very fast, and we got into a safe-ish area. But this Australian major then said to me, he said, "You know that track you crash-landed on?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You couldn't have landed anywhere else. It was all mined." They'd seen me come down from there, because they were up in their front line. They were up on the north, near the coast. And he said, "We couldn't come out to you while it was daylight. We had to wait until it got dark." And that's why they picked me up, and one of my sergeants was hit, and he bailed out over enemy territory. He was safe, and we got the message that he was safe, but he then became a prisoner of war. Sergeant Blatchford.
You have to spend some time with your sergeants. I mean, what would they look after you well?
Oh, yes, yes. They took me back to their place and they looked after me. I had somewhere to sleep the night. And then the next day, I couldn't contact my unit because we had no direct line from the very front. They were right up in the front line, you see, these Australians. And so I had to stay with them for another day until they were able to contact the army headquarters, and they sent out a vehicle for me and took me back to the British headquarters. So this all took about 2 or 3 days.
Now, had you been reported? Well, you must
yes.
have been reported missing.
Yes.
Did they know you were where you were at all?
No, they had no idea. No, they thought I'd had it and I was reported missing.
And did that go right back to your family?
Oh, no.
So it was cut off before?
Yeah. And as a result of that, there was a thing called the Late Arrivals Club. And That's the certificate which was issued eventually.
It's never too late to come back, is
the thing. Yes, that's the motto.
So, was this a proper club or was this a joke thing?
No, it was a proper club. And I got a little silver badge with a winged boot. And I haven't got it now, unfortunately.
Did they have functions to Late Arrivals Club? Did they have functions, you know? I mean, would they have a...
Oh, no.
So it was just a thing?
Yes. Yeah.
What was your reception like when you came back?
Well, when I got back to the squadron, they were absolutely amazed to see me, because they thought I'd had it. They'd seen me go down, or some of them had, and I had no idea what had happened to me, and of course couldn't make contact with them after the Australians picked me up, so I was missing for 2 or 3 days, and I was posted as missing. So they were very pleased to see me.
Now, one thing I was quite interested in was you had an escape kit.
Yes.
We haven't discussed this. Did you have that all the time when you
Yes. We used to carry it in the linings of our pockets.
And what was it? What did it consist of?
A little compass. Which you could hang, suspend, and then give you an idea of direction. What else do we have? There wasn't very much, but oh Lord, what else was there? Less than I remember. It was only a small pack, and we used to, I think it was probably a bandage or something like that in it.
And a letter as well to any Arabs that found you.
Oh, yes, I've got a copy of that somewhere. Telling the Arabs to do all they could to help us. Yes, of course there was that. Oh, gosh. And on Lenin. See, once again, I could get these things, but
they won't be able to see it. I mean, they can look at the, you know, associated things.
Yes, in the it's written in their hieroglyphics, you know, and it was a bit in English and what was said for our benefit.
So that was you. But now, one thing, having had quite an adventure there, what about the? We'll talk about some of the things. You seem to have, in the book, and again, I want to emphasise, because I know it's important, that we don't get carried away with the sort of drinking side of life and things. But you do seem to have used your hurricanes to fly back to get some
yes.
supplies of beer.
Yes.
I was
yes.
quite interested in that. That sounded like an unusual
well,
use.
Well, Roy Marples.
Tell me about what
Roy Marples, the CEO of the squadron, who I told you was a great chum of mine. He said, Pete, we ought to have a bit of beer up here in the bloody desert. He said, you know, do us all good. And so what we did, we took all the ammunition out of the ammunition boxes in the wings and flew down to Alexandria. And they had an officer's mess down there. It was a pre-war RAF station. And we went down there and picked up some beer, and canned beer, we put in these ammunition holds. And we had three of us went down. So when we came, we got managed quite a lot of beer aboard. So we got back and we were able to spread it around amongst the chaps a bit. So they were very appreciative of it.
Was canned beer new then? I mean, I always think of it as a modern thing, but they had canned beer then, did they?
Yes.
But was it quite new or considered new? Or?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember. It tasted all right, anyway. Couldn't have been too old.
Now, the other thing is, did you get a chance to go back on local leave, things like, you know...
the place we used to go to, if we had, say, one night off, or maybe two, We used to go to Alexandria.
Oh, that was always the choice, was it?
Yeah. Oh, it was the nearest, you see.
Of course it is, yes. I'm my geography. Now, what would you do when you went to
well, we
you've
used
heard a story about marbles. Marbles does seem to have been a failure. I see what you mean when you see it's a live one.
Yeah.
Tell us some stories of just carousing in Alexandria then.
Again, well, we used to, first of all, we used to book into a hotel. The first thing we used to do was to have a bath. We'd been in the desert for God knows how long. There was sand everywhere in our clothes. And we took some clean clothes. And we'd go out. And first thing we'd do is to go and have a drink. And we used to go to, after having been in the usual places, then later on we go to a place where they had a sort of a dance hall place, and an Egyptian dance man. Terrible, they were terrible. And they had a singer there. It was awful. And Roy Marbles, he'd had a few, he went up on the stage, a small stage. This singer was standing by a microphone. He pushed him away from the microphone and grabbed it. And he, there were a lot of our boys at the back of the bar. So we were fight, you know, Churchill doing it. We were fight on the beaches, we were fight on the land, we were fight in the air, and what's more, this place was called the Monseigneur, by the way, and what's more, we were fight in the Monseigneurs. He pushed this chap away. Next thing is, a whole... The band had packed up to grab Roy Marple, so we went up and got hold of him and got him away. And the Egyptians called for the military police. So we nipped out quickly and got away in time.
A fairly jolly occasion.
Yes, yes, it was.
Now, what about when you were back in the thing? How are operations going? Because the Germans then start a tremendous retreat, and you know, right across the North Africa.
Yes.
November, December. Which means, I presume, that you'd have to move.
Yes. Well. Oh, yes. We had to move forward to keep up with the troops. Now, we moved up on the 7th of November. He said, I had my due on the 4th of November, and then on the 7th of November, I was back. We moved further forward to another forward landing group because the army had moved forward quite a lot, and we were then patrolling over Merzimatru Harbour. And a convoy outside the harbour. So they were getting convoys up with supplies for the army. And they were using the harbour there, so we had to make sure that they were well protected.
So you're on convoy patrol, protecting them from...
Well, we flew over the harbour area all the time. I could patrol over Merzimatru Harbour and convoy outside the harbour.
And were the convoys attacked while you were patrolling?
No, not by aircraft, because we were keeping the aircraft away. But I've got here.
We
saw two mines blow up in the water. So I didn't see any ships hit, but certainly they were in quite a danger area.
And were you involved at all in the pursuit?
Oh yes, yes. Then we moved. This is on the 7th of November, we moved up there, and then we moved again further forward to a landing ground called 101. I can't remember exactly where it was, but it was somewhere in the Merzimatru area, obviously. Then it was decided that we were going to the Germans had started to retreat, and of course they could only go on the coast road. They couldn't take these hundreds and hundreds of vehicles across the desert. And therefore, they were on this coast road, and they were nose to tail, mile after mile of them. And it presented a good target for us to strafe.
And what do you remember of those ground strafing? I mean,
well,
it must have been the easiest target you'd had ever had.
In some ways it was. But what we did, I don't know whether you know the North African coast there. It comes along and then there's a bit of a bulge by Derna, and then it comes round, you've got Benghazi, and it comes down for quite a bit and then goes round. Do you know the North African coast? Well, it was decided that what we were going to do was to go forward to just a bit of sand where they'd got some knowledge of previously when one of these earlier advancements. And they sent two squadrons, ourselves, and the other one was number 33. So we moved up a total air operation to this bit of sand. It was 400 miles west of where we were. And we moved in there, had no sleeping accommodation or anything. We slept in the open. And all our supplies were brought in by Hudson's, the RAF Hudson's, and they bring in food and fuel for the aircraft and cans, big square cans. And we were there, we got there in the afternoon. We moved up on the on the 13th of October. We called it Landing Ground 125.
13th of November, I suspect.
It was November, yeah. 13th of November. We moved up there. And later that day, we did our first job. And we strafed the road between Benghazi and Ajadabia. That was coming down south from Benghazi. There's Ajadabia and Agela, another place. So in that north-south stretch of Libya.
And what was it like, ground strafing like that, along a road? I mean,
well, you see, these vehicles were nose-to-tail. So what we did, I was leading the squadron on a few occasions, we flew in line abreast, so that we all went in, strafing this road, about 30 or 40 yards apart from me, and so we covered quite a long stretch of road with 12 aircraft. We went in, and then we would turn, alter, I'd say, right, turn port, reciprocal, we come back the other way, strike from that way, and we do, right, one more, and we did that twice. And we destroyed hundreds of vehicles. And I got here.
You could see them catching fire and...
Oh, yes, very often. And, of course, the loads of men on board them, all trying to escape to a safe area. And that very first, we arrived there on the 13th, and we did a trip that day. We had no... And we used to go out at low level all the way. And it was about 180 miles from where we were to that road. So it took us about three-quarters of an hour to get there. And then we had long-range tanks fitted, and then we had to come all the way back again and find that we had no radio aids whatsoever. But it just so happened that there was one huge sand mound, and we used to call it the Sugar Loaf. And that was with the good visibility that you had. Although you couldn't see an airfield, with it all being all sand, we could see this big, I suppose it must have been about 20 or 30 feet high. Extraordinary thing, I don't know how it got there. Natural production, I suppose. Anyway, that was our navigational aid.